So now, without further ado, I want to introduce to you my colleague and great friend and mentor, Dr. Melissa Moskar. She's the associate professor in the Department of Dermatology and the Departments of Obstetrics and Gynecology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. She earned her medical degree at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. She completed her dermatology residency at Georgetown University Hospital, MedStar Washington Hospital Center, and is certified by the American Board of Dermatology. Dr. Moskar is the founder and director of Gynecologic Dermatology Clinic at UT Southwestern, a tertiary referral center serving Texans and the surrounding states. She has a passion for educational initiatives for dermatology and gynecology. She works with the residents and the PAs to improve the recognition, diagnosis, and treatment of vulvar dermatoses. In addition to patient care, Dr. Moskar has research interests in both lichen sclerosis and Stevens-Johnson syndrome and toxic epidermal necrolysis. Dr. Moskar lectures worldwide on vulvar dermatoses, and she's a member of the Executive Council of the North American Chapter of the International Society for the Study of Vulvovaginal Diseases. Whew. But let me also just take a second to say that Dr. Moskar has trained, and one of her best qualities, I say, is that she can deal with various different situations. She makes her patients feel very comfortable with her, and she allows them to tell things that help her as a clinician diagnose them and treat them. So she is beloved by her patients, which I think is something, right, that we all strive to be. So thank you, Dr. Moskar, and thank you for giving us this lecture on genital dermatology. Right. Well, thank you guys for sticking around. There's a lot more people here than I thought would be at 4:45. We're going to have a lot of fun today, so I hope you're ready. We're going to be going through a couple different learning objectives, basically developing a practical clinical approach to the evaluation of genital disorders. I hope that you come away from here with more tools in your toolkit about diagnosing and managing these conditions, and then also just reviewing some of the common pitfalls I see in my practice. My practice is about 90% women and 10% men, but I would say that most of pretty much everything we talk about is applicable to both sexes. So kind of just keep that in the back of your mind. So the first question I get often is, so what is a vulvar dermatologist? What is a genital dermatologist? Why did you go into this? And I'll say that I was not planning on it. I thought I was going to do procedural or pediatric dermatology, and then I came down and gave a lecture for Grand Rounds at UT Southwestern and presented these three cases of Langerhans cell histiocytosis, SGSTEN, and Kaposi sarcoma that looks like a second head on that penis. One of my colleagues came up and said, oh, you're going to be our genital person. And I was like, oh, wow, is this what I'm going to do? And I have loved every minute of it. I think that these patients are so vulnerable, and, you know, they've been to so many different people. And, you know, a lot of times in my clinic, I get so many referrals from PAs in the community. I'm very thankful to have a partner that's a PA so that we can increase the number of patients that we see. But a lot of these patients will go to urology or gynecology or family practice before ending up in dermatology. And so you guys really are the first line of defense a lot of times for these patients. So hopefully, like I said, you'll leave here with a lot more tools in your toolkit. I want to start by saying patients often won't tell you their genitals are involved unless you ask. So this patient, I actually saw her in the hospital. And she had bullous pemphigoid, and she had been treated for bullous pemphigoid by her dermatologist for a very long time. Her skin looked great, but she had no urethra anymore. Her labia majora had completely fused, and she actually had cicatricial pemphigoid or mucous membrane pemphigoid. But, you know, I think it's really important, again, to ask these patients, oh, you have psoriasis on your hands and your scalp. Is it on your penis or on your vulva? And they'll be like, oh, well, yes, it is. Well, how does that affect you? You know, what are you putting there? You know, is that affecting your sex life? And I think, honestly, it can just be those questions, just asked like that. And if you feel comfortable asking those questions, your patients are going to feel comfortable talking to you about things as well.
So kind of starting out with approach to the genital exam, this is not how to do an adult gynecologic exam. I wrote a JAD CME, and actually this was this came out a little bit beforehand, but the commentary of this technique was that this was going to make patients feel so much more comfortable because you wouldn't have to have your hands on the patient, you know, to spread the outside lips. You could use tongue depressors. So, you know, that's, in my mind, that's not a lot more comfortable, but, you know, just an example of what not to do. I think the most important thing for some of these patients is kind of setting the stage before your patients arrive. I have questionnaires in my practice, but even if it's just, you know, when your office staff is taking those questions, oh, what are you coming in for today? Oh, itch. And I mean, they're coming to me for my specialty practice. But your staff can kind of, you can either have questionnaires if they say that, oh, they have a problem in the genital area, or you can utilize these later on. I think that I kind of break these two, these patients into two groups, itch or pain. If it's an itch, does it make you want to rub and scratch, and does it feel good at first? That's my screening question for lichen simplex chronicus. And a lot of those patients will have that itch scratch cycle we need to talk about, just like anywhere else on their body. But when it affects the genital area, then I will say that it just kind of impacts their quality of life, I feel like, a lot more. I also want to know if they're getting sleep at night or if this wakes them up at night, because it changes how I treat them. They'll need oral medicines to help most often. And also pain. You know, I want to know if there's burning rawness or soreness when nothing is touching the area. And that's my screening question for pelvic floor dysfunction or vulvodynia. Vulvodynia we'll get into a little bit later, but that's, you know, when you have burning or pain when nothing else is wrong on the skin. And a lot of those patients will have pelvic floor dysfunction, like vaginismus or other reasons for the pain that we can actually evaluate and treat. I want to know if they're sexually active and if they have pain with sex. And I also want to know if they've ever had comfortable sex, because a lot of times these patients, you know, actually have never had comfortable sex, and that gives you some information as well. So I think it's really important for these patients to be in a gown with everything removed. And I mentioned yesterday in my lecture, I mean, I think when you have new patients, you really just want to set the stage, even for your skin exams, which we'll get into this later on. But if your, you know, office procedure is that everyone goes in the room, has a gown on, open to the back with nothing on, then it's really easy to examine these areas. You're not playing the awkward game of peek behind the underwear or, you know, pull this down, and it's kind of awkward that way. I let them know I reviewed their questionnaire, ask very pointed questions, and then I ask about washing, wipes, anything they're putting in their area. We'll get to this later on. And for a lot of these patients, you know, as I said, they'll come to you and they've seen three or four different other doctors, and they'll have a diagnosis sometimes. I like to ask them, oh, you have lichen sclerosis, or you have psoriasis. What do you know about that condition? There's a ton of social media, Facebook groups, support groups out there for patients. Some of that information is fantastic, and some of them is not. You know, some of these women come in and they make this borax paste, which is, you know, cleaning agent, and they like literally smear that on their vulva. So I mean, there's a lot of things that people are doing that are just not great. So after I ask the patient a question, I have my assistant enter the room. I hit a light. I have a patient put their feet in the footrest. For women, you know, all of our exam tables have these footrests. We just never use them, but they are there. And I have a kind of a systematic approach for the exam. For guys, I normally have them sit on the exam table. I pull out the footrest and then have them lay back. There's an AAD genital exam module that some of my colleagues have made, kind of an approach to the vulvar exam, an approach to the genital exam that's going to be on the educational sites, which is also going to be a really great resource. And so kind of talking about basics, I think what can be very intimidating, more so for kind of the vulvar exam than the exam of the penis, is that no one really knows what a normal vulva looks like, because there is no normal vulva. There's so many different types of vulvas. You know, there's artists that have, you know, books that show how many different types of vulvas there are. You know, a lot of women have lips that are on the inside, and some have lips that are on the outside. But our, you know, exposure to kind of different kinds of vulvas has been kind of morphed and modified, and there's so much body dysmorphic disorder happening right now in teens and 20-year-olds too. That could be a whole other talk. But like I said, sometimes lips are on the inside, sometimes lips are on the outside. And I will say that I do have patients coming in saying that they feel like their vulvas does not look normal. You know, what should they do? Should they have their lips, you know, removed, labiaplasty? There's this book that I have in my office. I have a couple, actually, that when I have these patients, I'll kind of just bring the book for them to flip through. There's a lot of websites now as well that are available for patients. You know, there's... This is kind of just a normal anatomy photo to review. But, I mean, I think that, you know, talking to patients about the word, you know, vulva, using those kind of terms for patients instead of, like, their hoo-ha, their whatnot, their pancake. I mean, I think my husband always says that my 2.5-year-old says that the pee comes from her bulba. And I know that, you know, we'll see how they do as they get older. But I think it's really important to have these proper terms, you know, because, you know, I've heard stories of people, you know, oh, you know, my friend was playing with my pancake, and maybe, you know, that child abuse or whatnot, right? So, I mean, I think teaching our kids and everyone really proper terminology is really important. That's a whole other soapbox of mine. Redness is normal, especially on the vulva, and I think what's hard is a lot of women will get itching or pain, and they'll look down, they'll see red, and then they'll flip out, and for the next, you know, 3 years, the redness will be what's driving the show. I like to tell them that that's fine, it's normal, we just don't normally look down there, and I do have patients that send me my charts. At 9 o'clock, it's fuchsia, at 10 o'clock, it's purple, at 11 o'clock, it's light pink and lavender, and I tell them, please stop looking at your vulva. Spend more time interacting with the human life around you. You can have multiple labia minora. These are pearly, vulvar vestibulae, analogous to the pearly penile papules. And I will say that there's lots of, you know, guys that will have these and they'll want them lasered off or cryoed off. I try to tell my patients that, you know, think of it as being ribbed for your pleasure, right? And so, you know, that maybe your future partner will be very thankful that you have this down the road. And this is a normal variant that a lot of people have. Sometimes that goes over well. Sometimes they look at me like, but, you know, I think these often get mistaken for warts. And these will be, you know, frozen off or, you know, curetted or biopsied, more from kind of OB family urology. Remember that they're dome-shaped and discreet, and they're very, very, very common. And so I think just reassuring patients that this can be a normal finding is incredibly helpful. I do not biopsy these for patients. I try to reassure them. There's a lot of different apps we have on our phones now, or even Google, and I'll bring up, you know, a photo, and I'll show a patient, like, you know, from either an app or from a textbook or from online. I'm like, look, doesn't that look like you? It's normal, normal variant. Here's the term. You can go read about it, but we don't have to cut these off. We don't have to do any other procedures. The vulva also kind of changes over time. So there's also a huge push for, you know, vaginal and vulvar rejuvenation. And I tell my patients, you know, over time, this sags, these sag, and everything on the bottom gets tucked up. And that's just how, you know, things go. And so, you know, over time, the labia minora gets smaller, we lose a little bit of the hair, the mucous membranes become pale, thin, and smooth. And sometimes it can be really difficult to distinguish normal vulvar aging from lichen sclerosis. I even sometimes get, you know, have to kind of think twice, have patients come back 6 months down the line, look for any interval change, look for texture change. Like I said, we're going to go over a little bit of that in a minute. The genitourinary syndrome of menopause, again, this is when people have dryness, and can have pain with sex, a little bit of pale color in the vulva, and a large majority of women are symptomatic from this. This is just losing estrogen over time in the vulva. Local estrogen is incredibly safe. to use, but a lot of patients are afraid to use local estrogen. Unlike kind of the hormonal shifts that happen over time with menopause, the longer you go from menopause, the greater impact that this can have on your life. So, you know, if the perimenopausal period is, you know, around 5 years, say, from, you know, 49 to 55, it varies for every person, but a woman in her 80s is going to be a lot more symptomatic than when she started, you know, in her 50s. But I tell all of my patients that age is very relative. I have patients in their 80s having much better sex than my patients in their 40s. So I feel like time is very relative, and I think it's important to have all these conversations no matter what. And I think that a lot of patients will say, well, you know, irritant contact is one of the most common conditions that I see in my clinic. And so I tell them that, you know, this is not something you have to live with. There are things we can do. And I mean, even if you're 70, 80, 90 years old, you know, you still have a great quality of life that we can improve upon. It's not something you have to live with. So talking a little bit more about vulvovaginal atrophy or that genitourinary syndrome of menopause, just having more sex sometimes can increase the lubrication in the vagina. There's tons of over-the-counter lubricants, and we'll go over those a little bit more in deep detail. And then there's moisturizers. So lubricants you use with sex, moisturizers that you just do on a regular basis, 3 times a week, and then local estrogen. I actually have a whole handout that I give patients on lubricants and the different type, water-based, oil-based, or silicone-based. The water-based lubricants are ones that I like. They're a little bit more sticky. The silicone-based lubricants, patients like they're a little bit more slick. And then, you know, everyone wants natural things. So my patients love coconut oil. And I tell them, you know, as long as they're not a diabetic or getting recurrent yeast infections, that's fine. It's kind of like you're on a tropical vacation. You know, you've got pina colada smell, have fun, whatever you want to do. But if you're getting, you know, yeast infections or you're a diabetic, then a lot of times that's not necessarily something you want to keep doing. You know, as I mentioned, local estrogen is very well tolerated. There's multiple different types. There's creams, there's dissolvable tablets, and then there's rings. I really like the dissolvable tablets because they're one of the lowest dose estrogens that you can get. They come on an applicator that's about the size of my finger, and there's a small little tablet on the top. Patient will use them twice a week, and it really just helps the lubrication. It can help with decreasing frequency of urination, and it can help dryness for patients. And like I said, it's tolerated very well. So now kind of switching gears, I think it's really important to look for subtle things, because sometimes these patients are coming in, they're miserable, they're waking up, you know, they're scrubbing themselves in the shower. If you look at her inner labial sulcus, so the line between her labia majora and the labia minora, you'll notice that there's just very, I mean, it's not subtle to me, but I look at vulvas a lot. But there's lichenification right in that line there, and that's exactly where she was itching and scratching. This patient has a hairline fracture, a paper cut. You can see on the upper, her upper right inner labial sulcus, and these are very common. They feel like paper cuts. You can get them from chronic candida. You can get them from irritant or atopic dermatitis, and you can also get them from early lichen sclerosis. So just something to kind of keep in mind when you see those linear fissures. As I mentioned, irritant contact dermatitis is super common in my practice. And if you had this patient and you took a look at her, you'd be like, oh yeah, you know, you've got a little bit of texture change, you've got some erosions there. She was, you know, wearing pads all the time. She was, you know, changing her pads very frequently, but unless you open the lips, you don't see, you know, you see now that she's lost her anatomy, she doesn't have labia minora anymore, I couldn't retract her clitoral hood, and she's got the pink from the irritant on top of depigmentation from lichen sclerosis. So although I think anytime people see a painful erosion in the genitals, they automatically think of HSV, and I will say, I think that's one of the most important things you want to rule out. So this was not a subtle presentation of HSV, but I will say that sexually transmitted disease are actually some of the least common things I see in my clinic, because by the time they get to us as, you know, as dermatologists. They basically have been ruled out for everything under the sun. You know, they'll have like 8 different swabs for HSV, or, you know, they'll get the blood test and then be devastated. I never do blood tests on patients. I just, you know, if there's an erosion, I'll swab it and do a PCR. But I mean, this, you know, they're scalloped, they're very tender, and they can be really severe. So this patient actually, this was a consult we had in the hospital, and he had zoster, but they brought him to the OR because they were worried about necrotizing fasciitis because the patient was in so much pain, you know. But you can see the scalloped lesions, and they're healing at this point. But a lot of other physicians, you know, healthcare providers just don't see as much on the skin as we see. You know, this patient also has HSV. You can see those very well demarcated scalloped lesions. But if you look closely, she's also had genital mutilation surgery. So her inside lips have been cut out, and her clitoris was removed. And so you can actually, you know, glean and learn a lot from patients by looking at their genitals. This patient, this is what happens when you put clobetasol in HSV. So there is a patient that we had treated in the hospital for pyoderma gangrenosum, and the surgeons were like, oh, she has PG, she's got it in her groin, just put some clobetasol on that. Well, she came into the ER and had urinary retention because her HSV was so out of control. And again, you can see those scalloped edges, and she needed IV acyclovir but did very well. This is zoster, and I will say that zoster looks really different on the penis than it does anywhere else on the body. There is a patient that we saw in the hospital, not this one per se, but if you just look at the lesions on the penis body there, you can see that they're grouped together, but they almost look black. And we had another patient that the resident who was staffing the patient with me, she's like, you know, they look like angiokeratomas, but I've just never seen something so painful. So I think that once you've seen what HSV or zoster can look like in the groin, then you kind of have that in the back of your mind. This one obviously wasn't subtle. It was running all the way down the backside of his leg. But again, just I feel like the more images you can see of these things, the better. So this is lichen sclerosis. This condition makes up about half of my practice, my outpatient practice, I should say. And you can tell, you know, I think when you see well-developed lichen sclerosis, this is not subtle, right? I mean, I think we can see this a mile away. There's a depigmentation, there's purpura, there's texture change, there's that tissue paper, wet tissue paper wrinkling, there's loss of anatomy structures on both patients. And so I feel like when you see a patient like this, I don't biopsy these patients any longer. I used to, but if it's a classic, very, you know, figure of eight, kind of your textbook lichen sclerosis patient, I will take a picture, and I'll put the picture in the medical record, and then I'll also give the picture to the patient, because if you can catch this early, before there's scarring, you can actually reverse a lot of the texture changes and color changes that these patients have, so that down the road, 4 or 5 years later, when their symptoms come back again, they'll see someone else, and they'll be like, I don't really think you have that. Stop using your medicine and, you know, let's see what happens. And so I think either a biopsy or you can take photos, whatever works well for your practice, in your practice setting, to give to that patient so they can take on and include in their medical record. So focusing here on women with lichen sclerosis, this is a prevalence of about 0.05% of the population. 79% of women were diagnosed between the ages of 45 and 65, but 16% were actually diagnosed between the ages of 18 and 44. And I'll say that there's been another large study that came out of premenopausal women with lichen sclerosis. These women often present with pain with sex and those fissures that I was telling you about. Sometimes you can just see erythema before you see that depigmentation. And so I think that if you have a patient, you know, in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and you notice that white texture change on male or female, I think keep this in the back of your mind, just because you don't have to lump it in the kids or the adults postmenopausal. So this is what lichen sclerosis looks like in a black patient. And you can see this patient, unfortunately, had been to 5 different other doctors, including 2 dermatology practices before she came to my clinic. And her daughter was like, you know, I've looked online. This is white. I think they you know, they're worried it's vitiligo. I think it's lichen sclerosis. And I was like, I think you're right. I mean, she's lost a lot of her anatomy. But again, looking in this photo, you can't see in the photo per se, but that lip is completely agglutinated. But you could see how, I guess, if they're wasn't the white in the figure of eight, there wasn't the texture change, and there was only a little erythema, you may think is this irritant and maybe just normal postmenopausal changes. But she has those thick, crinkly, the texture changes you can see on her buttocks. Her labia majora is starting to fuse to her inguinal fold as well. And she also had really severe irritant contact dermatitis. And so I will say that we'll get on this later on in the talk, but a lot of these people present with more than one thing going on. And until you get to the bottom of all of those things, they don't necessarily get better. A lot of women will kind of come and they'll get a diagnosis of yeast infections for years and years and years before a formal diagnosis. You can see she has those linear paper cuts on the sides with purpura, a little bit of texture change as well. This is another patient, and this is something that I think over the next 5 to 10 years that I'm hopefully going to, you know, study and learn a little bit more about with some of my colleagues. But I want to know what happens in early lichen sclerosis. And hindsight's always 20/20, right? So I saw this patient for the first time in December 2017. She had a 5-year history of burning, redness, you know, pain with sex. She'd been using intermittent steroids, antifungals. I did a biopsy and it showed a fungal infection. It was bright red. She was having pain. And so I was like, okay, let's treat you for yeast. You have some pain. You have some pelvic floor dysfunction. Let's circle back. I saw her every 6 months. She also had a lot of anxiety. We were treating that. She was getting a little better. But when she came in this time, she has a little bit of texture change on her clitoral hood, and her interlabial sulcus is starting to get a little bit more prominent. So, you know, I was starting to get worried about early lichen sclerosis, and I said, the next time you have your flare, come back in. We'll take a look. Maybe we'll do another biopsy. Well, fast forward, her husband was diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma, and they had a little bit of other things on their mind. But then he started doing better, was on immunotherapy. They started having sex. It became very painful. So she sent me a my chart. We got her back in, and this was her exam. So her clitoral hood had completely fused over her clitoral body. But after 3 weeks of twice daily clobetasol, gentle separation, we were able to kind of reverse those changes. And it was still early enough that we were able to kind of preserve a lot of her architecture. But it's very fascinating to me how, you know, there is a smoldering period, and I think that we just haven't really identified what that looks like yet. Because it can be very challenging. So both of these patients were diagnosed with early lichen sclerosis. The histopath is very nonspecific. I'm very thankful to work with an amazing dermatopathologist, Travis Vandergriff, and I think that, you know, we kind of dig deep in some of these patients, but a lot of times it's just CPC. And you really have to kind of use clinical judgment on what you're going to do for these patients. But again, when it's classic and it's been going on for a long time, I think it can be very obvious when it's lichen sclerosis that you want to have two different phases. You have your acute intervention, and again, this is relevant for both males and females. So acute intervention, the ultra-potent topical steroids, be it clobetasol, halobetasol, or augmented betamethasone dipropionate, 1 to 2 times a day for 8 to 12 weeks. I use it twice a day when they have erosions or they have thickening. Otherwise, I just use it once a day. And then you want to taper them down to a maintenance phase. So tapering the strength of the steroid that controls their signs of disease and their symptoms 3 times a week. This is another case I thought was kind of cute. He had a little smiley face there on his glands. He pulled back the foreskin's little flower. Little sunflower. For male patients, you know, a lot of patients will get circumcised, and that does help a lot with the lichen sclerosis that they've developed, also called BXO. But those patients still need maintenance steroids. And a lot of times that can be just a low potency like desonide or hydrocortisone, just to make sure that their disease doesn't flare and cause more scarring down the line. This study came out, and this kind of changed the way we practice. So, you know, this group looked at 500 women with lichen sclerosis that went into remission. I actually give this article to my patients, and I have it printed for them. I like to show it to them because they can see other women with lichen sclerosis, and they can see, you know, what they look like compared to other people that have this condition. But this group took, you know, these 500 women. Once they went into remission, they had two groups. So one group that was compliant, they used a topical steroid, whether they had symptoms or not, zero developed skin cancer, and 3% had adhesions and scarring. The other group that used things as needed, so that's like, oh, I have itching or pain, I'll use my clobetasol for 1 or 2 days, then I'll take 3 weeks off or 2 months off, and kind of that intermittent dosing, 40% had further scarring, and 5% developed skin cancer. And so for me, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I've got patients in their 80s that are having way more sex than patients in their, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s. And so for me, that preservation of architecture is what's so important. So I kind of stress that with my patients. And I will, like I said, go over the abstract with them and then send this home with them as well. So switching gears, this is lichen planus. So there's the, you know, classic purple papules that are polygonal and really pruritic. And then there's the erosive lichen planus that you see here as well. This is psoriasis, and I'd say that for the most part, psoriasis can kind of sneak up on you when it's in the genitals. You don't classically see the scale like you see in this picture, especially when it's in the inguinal folds. So it can be really challenging. And I think when you biopsy psoriasis in the groin, it also can be very, very nonspecific. And so I think I go off of clinical and I biopsy when I need to. A lot of times, like I said, it can be difficult if they don't have psoriasis other places. So if they have psoriasis on their elbows and the scalp and the hands, and they also have it in the genitals, I think it's a lot easier than when it's just local genital disease. You do have to use high-potency topical steroids, and a lot of these patients will need systemic medication, just like your patients with scalp disease. I mentioned this in my talk yesterday, but, you know, our patients with psoriasis, there's this study that came out a couple years ago, 63% of patients reported genital involvement. But how often do you ask your patients, you know, about if they have psoriasis in the groin? I have to tell you, like, before I went into this specialty area, I did not ask that question. And even at when residents or other providers staff patients with me, they'll always ask, oh, well, do you have any, you know, anywhere else on the body? Are you sure you don't have it anywhere else in the body? Because they know they're going to staff with me. And then I walk in and I'm like, oh, well, do you have it on your penis or your vulva? And they're like, well, yes, I do. And so I feel like if you don't ask those like targeted questions, you're going to get a very nebulous answer. And this really does, you know, itch. It can infect their, you know, relationships. This can make them very depressed and anxious because it's something they can't talk about. I feel like one of the biggest things that I want you guys to take away is when you're doing skin exams, because how many skin exams do you guys do? And how much time do you have to do skin exams? Like zero, right? When you have patients, you know, you have anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes to see patients. But I'd say that most dermatologists don't regularly examine the vulva. Or if you do, it's like a peek under the underwear, or, you know, for guys, like I said, move things from side to side, look at the scrotum. But how often do you like retract the foreskin or have patients retract the foreskin? We really want to try to catch vulvar, vaginal, genital melanoma early. Many gynecologists actually stop seeing patients regularly after 65. And if we don't look, we're not going to find things. The next patient, I'll show you a picture of, she actually presented to her gynecologist for vaginal bleeding because she had this spot. This was a nodular melanoma. The patient had metastatic disease, lungs, brain, everywhere. This was the primary. You know, this patient wasn't necessarily seen in our practice at the time, but she's been following up with our melanoma specialist after removal of this tumor. But you never know what's going to be hiding down there, right? And I feel like the reason why a lot of these patients have such high morbidity mortality when they have genital melanoma is because people stop looking. Dermatologists don't look down here, and gynecologists don't see patients. And, you know, I will say that the guys, when they notice things on their penises, they come in really quickly. But women don't look. And so, you know, I think that, like I said, when I do skin exams, I have patients lay down. And I'll have them, you know, remove their underwear before they lay down. And then when you go, you know, you start on one side, you move around, and then you just say, okay, can you frog leg? You know, you look at the vulva, you spread the lips, you move around to the other side. I mean, it literally takes like 5 seconds. But if you don't have that infrastructure in your clinic, or if you're, you know, okay, stand like this, and you're awkwardly like bending down, I mean, I think, you know, make things easy on you. Everyone does things differently, but I think there are ways that we can integrate this into our practice. This is, you know, spot the melanoma. It's the one with the large patch on the right labia majora. I really thought this patient with vitiligo, I thought that was going to be a melanoma. It turned out to be a seborrheic keratosis. And the photo in the middle, that is early lichen sclerosis. You can see the little depigmented atrophic papules. And then there's pigment that's kind of remaining when the inflammation goes down, called vulvar melanosis. I'll show you an article in a minute about that. I think that can look really scary sometimes. You can have lots of different colors, lots of different pigment. So I do think that doing a biopsy of the darkest spot a lot of times is good to do, especially if you have any question whatsoever. You can do dermoscopy on the vulva. There was a little clinical like expert guidance that came out in the JAD a couple months ago about getting the old school projector film. I don't know if you guys remember, like the overhead projector people used to like write on. But you can get those transparent sheets and cut them in half, and then like use that as a shield on the vulva, and it helps like the mucosa lay flat. You could also use that on the penis and the scrotum. So as a way to kind of examine things down here. Pigmented lesions are very common. Most of the lesions are benign, but like I said, if we don't catch the melanomas early, then they can go on to progress. And I'd say that ABCs of the melanoma in the genital area, I mean, we can't really use our classic markers because people don't look down here. The color can be very uneven. They do evolve over time. You can still see that blue-white veil, though. It's still very common. I thought this was a melanoma. So this patient was sent by our physical medicine and rehab team, and they said, wow, you know, everyone's been seeing her and no one's done anything. I'm really worried. This was actually an oncology nurse who had been spending her whole career educating other people about cancer screening, and then she developed this. I presented this as a melanoma in situ because initially it was like an early evolving melanoma in situ. Is that what it could be? And I presented this at a conference, and one of my mentors said, she has lichen sclerosis and you're going to see that later. And sometimes, you know, pigment looks weird in patients that have lichen sclerosis. And lo and behold, if you see her clitoral hood, it was really hard to retract, and she developed some white depigmentation also there a little bit later on down the road. And so these melanocytic nevi that occur with LS can kind of have an activated phenotype, and it really can mimic melanoma that can be very challenging to diagnose. This came out 20 years ago, and I like to think I'm up to date on LS literature, but I wasn't reviewing literature from like 20 years ago. But this came out recently, and because it's, you know, it's on the penis, it's new and novel, I'm like, oh, this has been going on for a long time. Does anyone know what this is? The spot that you see? This is one of those nodules on the penis that you see with this guy. It's my favorite. They're swimming. This is what a scabies mite looks like when you use the immersion, the mineral oil, instead of the KOH. But you can get little nodules on the penis when patients have scabies. You don't always see it, but when you see that, it's a nice a pathognomonic finding. So this is a fixed drug eruption. Remember, it loves the genitals. It also likes the oral mucosa and around the eyes. A lot of times in urology, gynecology, family practice, we'll get referrals for recurrent Stevens-Johnson's. I don't know if you guys have seen that before. And it's really the fixed drug eruption. This patient was treated for about 12 years for tinea cruris in his groin. And it just wasn't getting better. It was getting thicker, you know, wasn't responding. Finally had a biopsy and showed extramammary Paget's disease. And these are really hard. It is often a delay in diagnosis. I feel like, you know, dermatophytes or tinea cruris is very, very common. This is not. But I think that if you see something that's not responding to therapy, kind of always step back. You know, if it's been 6 months, 12 months, and patients aren't getting better the way you think they should be, you know, don't hesitate to do a biopsy just because it's in the groin. It can be a primary disease versus secondary spread from internal malignancy like adenocarcinoma. So it's really important to get these patients in for a PET CT or to an oncologist to help with that workup. Local excision is mainstay of treatment. This always reoccurs. It's very frustrating for patients. This is a patient, I thought this was going to be an irritant contact dermatitis. This was also Paget's. She was putting hydrogen peroxide on this. So she probably also had irritant, but this came back as Paget's. And then this also is Paget's. And so this is, you know, a patient that was treated by urogynecology at our institution for 15 years. And they kept lasering and, you know, chasing things with Aldera and doing other things. We actually just recently published her case, and we used local radiation as a palliative treatment. And it healed a lot of these erosions, and she did amazingly better. But like I said, a lot of times these patients will be jumping around from other specialties, and really when they get to you, you know, we kind of have to just make sure that we take care of them. So now jumping into kind of the last part of my talk, kind of want to go over some pearls and pitfalls for some of these patients. And as I mentioned yesterday, a lot of these patients have a lot of anxiety. They've been carrying around these diagnoses for a long time. This is an example of an excerpt from one of my questionnaires. I saw her in 2015, and she had this since 1955. She had been suffering with itching in her groin. She had lichen sclerosis, and that's what happens after 1 month of twice-daily clobetasol. And so it really is incredible the difference that we can have with very simple interventions and listening for these patients. I have the luxury of time, so I do get to spend a lot of time with these patients. But if you don't have that, you can see them over a several, you know, week period. Have them come back frequently, you know, if you think something else is going on or whatnot. I love, like, dumping patients' bags of stuff out on the counter and kind of rifling through what people have thrown at them. Because typically, like I said, by the time they get to me and to you guys, because like I said, when they come to derm, they don't always think about derm as the first stop, right? They go to family first. They mention it. Well, first they go down to the aisle of the drugstore, right? Then they, like, pull everything off the aisle things. They try everything themselves because they don't want to talk to a doctor. Then they'll talk to their family doctor and who will send them to urology or gynecology, and then they'll finally make their way into derm. So I like to kind of sift through and see what people have got in their bag of tricks. And then I want to know how they clean and if they're using wet wipes, because they're always using wet wipes. And I will say that I tell my patients, I've got the cleanest patients in Texas, probably in the country. But no matter how much you clean, this is not dirty. That's not why you have, you know, your rash down here. And sometimes over-cleaning can strip all those good moisturizers away from your body. So we really have to, you know, stop that and intervene. I want to know how they clean. So if they use wet wipes, you know, what do they do after sex? Do they use soap? Do they use a washcloth? I showed this image yesterday for those of you that were in my session, but this patient was referred for recalcitrant vulvar lichen sclerosis. And when I saw her, the first thing that jumped out to me were these scalloped, punched-out erosions. So I did a swab for HSV, PCR, but something just wasn't making sense. She actually was aggressively cleaning herself, okay? And she came in with her husband. I have a screening questionnaire. She said that she did think about committing suicide from this condition. She did not have an active plan, and we discussed that with her and her husband. But I had to kind of backtrack and figure out what was going on. Well, it turns out along the way, she was given a big bottle of lidocaine. So what she would do is she would put the lidocaine on about 30 minutes before showering, and then in the shower, she would rub and scrub her vulva for 30 minutes while crying until all the little white spots went away because she thought the white spots were dirt. Well, she was actually scrubbing, literally scrubbing her skin off for 30 minutes, And we all know when skin gets macerated, it turns white, right? And so she was just having this itch, you know, scratch pain cycle. And, you know, so after addressing how she was, because she was given the right medicine, she was given the right diagnosis, but, you know, you really have to kind of sometimes lean in and dig deep to find out what patients are doing. And so this is what she looked like 2 weeks after, you know, treating her HSV and getting her to stop cleaning in the shower. And so then at this point, I started using topical steroids as well. And she was a completely new woman. I mean, they had a trip planned. They went on a cruise. You know, they were able to have sex again. It was just, I mean, it's amazing. I'm getting the goosebumps. I mean, how much of an impact you can have on these patients and how much better you can make their lives. I think addressing incontinence is incredibly important. And I kind of ease into this. So I ask, you know, do you have leaking when you cough or sneeze? Because, you know, I think in patients' minds, that's an acceptable type of incontinence to have. And I think for a lot of patients, this is more embarrassing and harder to talk about than having pain with sex. I also ask them how often do they go to the bathroom. And you'll be amazed. I had one patient that had horrific irritant dermatitis in her inguinal folds because she went to the bathroom 30 times a day, and every time she went to the bathroom, she got a full bottle of water and poured it over her vulva. And so even just plain water, when you're, you know, rinsing yourself like that, can cause a severe irritant contact dermatitis. I also want to know if, you know, with exercise, if they're jumping, if they have leakage, and how this impacts their quality of life. I also let them know they don't have to live with this, right? There are things we can do. There's pelvic floor physical therapy, there's urologists, there's urogynecology. So we really can address this and help patients get better. And again, I think, you know, not many dermatologists talk to their patients about sex. I think the residents and the PAs, when they first work with me, are like, oh my gosh, I didn't know that we could ask these questions. This could be a whole other talk on its own, but I think asking those direct questions is important. You know, are you sexually active? And if you are, does it hurt? Is it hurt at the beginning, the middle, or the end? If it's at the end, does it last a day or two or 10? And so, I mean, I think kind of getting down to the nitty-gritty of what's going on can really help with what your treatment plan is. I think it's important to take time to look for subtle changes. So, again, this patient has lichen sclerosis. She was 22 years old. She was diagnosed at the age of 4, but then things got better after she started her period. She stopped using her topicals. She had this really firm, hard, eroded papule. And I will say that, you know, if this wasn't firm and painful with an erosion, a lot of times if it's just hyperkeratotic, I'll treat them, have them come back, and then if there's anything that remains, I'll do a biopsy. But if it's firm and painful with an erosion, you want to do a punch biopsy. And this came back as an invasive squamous cell carcinoma. So as I mentioned before, you know, sometimes people are nervous about biopsying the genitals. You don't want to biopsy midline because there's a lot of tension there. And so a lot of times that can cause problems healing down the road. You only want to biopsy if you notice something wrong. Don't biopsy a blind spot that a patient is pointing to unless you notice texture change. There's a papule there. You know, there's some sort of visual clue, because if you just blindly biopsy, you're going to get a very, you know, non-specific path report back. And you only need multiple biopsies if there's different morphologies. And this is how I was taught to do modified shave biopsies by my mentor, and it works great. So you basically can get a proline stitch. I have a C17 needle, which is just a very small needle, and you have your assistant hold tension on that stitch, and then you can use either you know, curved iris scissors, or I use gradle scissors to take a very small piece of skin, and it heals beautifully. Use a little dry sol to stop the bleeding. I use this for lichen sclerosis, lichen planus. I use this in the mucosa when you're doing, you know, oral biopsies, and also do this on the penis. As I mentioned, it heals incredibly well. I think you want to do punch biopsies in the genital area when you're worried about skin cancer. This patient came to me, and I was like, okay, this is cancer until proven otherwise, and it's not projecting very well, but she has all these, like, filiform projections, and she had been seeing her gynecologic oncologist every 3 months for 2 years, and every time she went in, he would do a biopsy, and it wasn't cancer, and it wasn't cancer, and it wasn't cancer, so he sent her to me, and I was like, what's happening? And so I pulled the path and looked at it. Well, he was taking little snip excisions of the little filiform projections, but he wasn't doing a deep biopsy, you know, under the plaque. And so I, you know, sent a picture, annotated photo with a bunch of different circles. It's like, oh, you should biopsy this and this and this. He ended up just excising the whole thing, but this also was invasive squamous cell carcinoma. So, I mean, I think that, you know, if you see a patient and you do a biopsy and it doesn't match with what you see clinically, you know, question that, right? I think go back, get some more tissue, you know, reframe things. I use Vaseline after biopsies basically as many times as possible. Women do really well except patients with underlying vulvodynia, and I think it can be really hard for guys to get biopsies in this area. I do tell patients I'm taking a small piece of their penis and there will be a scar. And I've seen, you know, a lot of people try to put stitches in on the penis. Those can pop. And so I, you know, don't recommend doing that. This is a nice set of follow-up care instructions I actually got from one of my patients, because I told him, you know, I want to know what the experience is and, you know, how can we make this better for future patients. And he said, you know, expect 6 to 8 weeks of healing before sexual contact feels normal. No contact, he said, you know, nothing, no intercourse or any, you know, friction-related action for more 1 month. You know, that obviously there's going to be limited natural arousals after a week, but to begin stretching the skin, but really no friction or rubbing. And then he said, you know, thank you for engaging me on the usual quick bullshit response. You made me feel not crazy, and that was huge help right out the gate. So I think, again, just listening sometimes to patients, asking those direct questions and not just, like, dancing around things, they're coming to you for help. So I think that's, you know, an important take home. I think this is important. But show patients how to apply their medicine. If you don't teach them, then they're not going to know what to do. I have them kind of sit up in the chair so they can see what I'm doing. And this is what happens if they don't do it correctly. And I will say patients get, you know, really scared about topical steroids because they hear from their family practice doctor, they hear from the pharmacist, oh God, they want you to use what strength of steroid where? Oh no, just do that for 2 weeks and then stop. Well, this patient, for instance, was using about, you know, a month's worth of medicine. She'd close her eyes, rub it between her thighs. And so she had striae everywhere. She had erythema on her labia majora, and she needed to get it like all the way in there. But she had no idea, right? Because we don't go over those things with patients. We're like, oh, you have a biopsy. It's lichen sclerosis. I called in a medicine for you. See you next year. And so I think that, you know, if you have an inkling that you're going to be starting something down here, I think taking the time to show them how much to do and where to put it will save you many phone calls down the line. You want to use about this much. It's about a lentil or half of a pea. This is an actual pea dyed blue, and it can cover two hands. So that's way more than a lot of people need. So I think just keeping that in mind when you talk to your patients. I actually print out my patients' photos. I call them their glamour shots. And they actually come in 8x10 photos. This is what happens when you print a photo right out of Epic, if you guys use Epic. But I draw on the photos. I kind of go over their image. I go over the anatomy. And I'll have them use this as a take-home guide. There's several patients that don't want to take it home. They don't want to look. And I was like, if we don't look, we're not going to get you better. And if this is really impacting things, we kind of need to go over that. One of my patients was like, what do I do when I go in the nursing home? I don't know what's going to happen. And I was like, well, you know, or what do I do if I die and my kids find this? What am I? I was like, well, you know, they fold it in half, they put it in an envelope, and it says on the outside, they write, like, burn or it's on you, you know, like, so, or they just tell me that they immediately shred it when they get home. And I'm like, well, whatever, as long as we went over it, you know, in person. If you don't have a printer, you can also, you know, take a picture on the patient's phone and annotate it for them and then have them put it in a hidden folder. So that's another way that you could go about it. We actually looked at a review of, this is one of the residence projects about, you know, a survey. So what do patients get before they come to this, like, specialty encounter? What did they get before? And then after they left the visit, was there anything that particularly stuck with them or they thought was particularly meaningful? And they said, you know, during this, like, my specialty encounter, the demonstration of location and how to apply the medicine and the photograph of their own body, listening, the amount of medicine, and then kind of just setting the stage and providing hope, I think those went a really long way. And again, you can use a lot of these things with just your psoriasis patients, right? I think, or your vitiligo patients. If you have a patient, you can take a photo. They come back in 3 months. You see that dramatic difference, but maybe unless the patient sees those subtle areas of repigmentation, they won't be as hopeful as they could have been. And as I mentioned before, patients often have more than one photo. This is one of my mentor's slides. And it's really often to have more than one thing going on. This patient had psoriasis, and when I walked into the room, I just couldn't stop staring at her hands, right? And so I was like, that was before I saw that vulva. But I saw her hands, and I was like, gosh, what's going on here? Well, she was putting vagicaine or benzocaine on her psoriasis. And so this is what happens, you know, after stopping that over-the-counter that can cause irritant and allergic contact dermatitis and using topical steroids. You can still see she has psoriasis, but those deep cribriform ulcers have improved tremendously. This is candidiasis and lichen sclerosis, can be very common. This is candidiasis with genitourinary syndrome of menopause mimicking LS. So I really thought this patient maybe had LS. And then this is just her KOH that you see under the microscope. This is a patient that came in, again, right diagnosis, lichen sclerosis, but her dermatologist didn't know that she actually stopped using the clobetasol about 5 years ago, and she was only using the special, you know, benzocaine, tetracaine, numbing agent that her dermatologist gave her. And so this is what happens after stopping that topical agent and starting a topical steroid. She still could use a little estrogen. She has some paleness in her vagina, but I mean, a long way from what she looked like before. And again, I think education is huge for these patients. This is another patient that was doing that smother method of a month's worth of medicine in the wrong place. This is what inside of her lips looked like. This is erosive lichen planus, and you want to biopsy where that yellow box is. So you want to do that modified shave biopsy at the junction between the epidermis and the erosion. That way you can see the lichenoid inflammation. You can still see the intact skin, and your dermatopathologist will have more information. If you do a biopsy right where that white circle is, they're just going to see chronic inflammation or granulation tissue. And a lot of the patients with erosive lichen planus can have vaginal involvement. A lot of the gynecologists don't know about this. And so I think it's important to, you know, treat them with vaginal hydrocortisone. You know, I think having a colleague in gynecology, I'm very fortunate to work with wonderful gynecologists to kind of help these patients. But you can do vaginal suppositories, and sometimes they do need surgery. And so either, you know, a gynecologist or urogynecologist or urologist that's comfortable doing vulvar surgeries to help with the vaginal adhesions as well as the narrowing of the introitus. So pelvic floor dysfunction, it's a very common cause of dyspareunia and vulvodynia. Vulvodynia, you know, patients often have underlying pelvic floor dysfunction. So I don't always use that term anymore because I feel like a lot of these patients will get labeled and they really have something else that can be driving the show. So I think it's important that we kind of address that. A lot of these patients will have comorbid anxiety, depression, as we talked about before. I like systemic agents for these. There's so many different topical compounds that people can try, but I think those only work because they get systemically absorbed through the vagina. Again, the targeted questions, lots of ask questions, talk about this. And again, not to give patients topical lidocaine to numb before sex. It's not the goal, just to like feel numb so you can have sex. Let's figure out why it's painful so we can make it pleasurable for you. So in closing, I think it's, you know, look for other parts of the body for clues. You know, if there's nonspecific erythema, look for psoriasis other places. Take time to show patients how to use those. If treatment isn't working, rethink your diagnosis. And again, I think having colleagues for that multidisciplinary approach is really important. You know, if you have a gynecology, urology practice that are close to you, you can build relationships with them. You know, they have a lot of these patients, and as I mentioned, you guys sometimes are the first line to kind of help these patients when they kind of switch gears from gynecology as well. So I think that is the end of my talk. Thank you guys so much for listening and sticking through. Happy to answer any questions you may have as well.
Thank you so much. We have a good amount of questions. That was great. Please continue to put your questions in, or you feel free to come to the mic. One of the questions was voted on. How can you differentiate, or how do you differentiate HSV versus shingles in the genitalia, specifically in females? Are you using a viral culture, or do you maybe just use it from history? Is it a recurrence or a single outbreak? What would you?
Yeah, every patient's different, right? So I think sometimes the patients will just exactly like tell you, you know, oh, I get the spot every time, the same place. I still like to do that. I like to do PCRs, HSV PCRs, because they're a little bit more sensitive. So I think that you can do those. And I think it's nice sometimes for patients to have that test result. But if it's the first time, like some of those images I showed you, I think doing a HSV and a VZV PCR is great to kind of help. And I default to the Zoster treatment course for patients, especially if it's the first time they've had any erosions, until I get those swabs back.
Is surgical reconstruction a good treatment option for LS, or does it have a high percentage of recurrence?
So after surgery, you have to keep treating to prevent, you know, recurrence of the skin disease. But when you have anatomy changes, so in men, if you cannot retract the foreskin, or in women, if there's a narrow introitus and the goal is to have penetrative sex, then, you know, you can start, and I often do have patients start with dilators or pelvic floor physical therapy, but, you know, if their introitus looks like this and you can barely get, you know, one finger on the inside, I'd be very surprised if dilators and physical therapy alone can help. And so that's when you kind of, you know, need to reach out and have your colleagues help. And I can't get my derm surgeons to do surgeries down here. If you guys work with derm surgeons, please empower them to own the skin everywhere. I think, you know, we can work on that. But I am very fortunate to work with wonderful gyn surgeons. So we kind of collaborate in that respect.
Borax, dot, dot, dot. Why?
I don't know. Well, so I think what's hard for a lot of these patients, and again, I mean, I think that we only learn the more we talk about it, right? So a lot of these patients, that the ring phone call, you have LS, I'll see you next year, that's sometimes the only information they get, right? And so just like all of us, what do you do when you get a diagnosis? You Google. And I think, as I mentioned, I tell patients, I'm like, you know, the support groups are great so that you know you're not the only person that has this. But if you have questions, bring them to me. Because on the support groups, you never know what patients are going to have. A lot of times they have eight different things going on, and maybe you're early in your course and they're later on. So I think that, you know, they're just looking for information. And there's like a subset of people. They just like we do bleach baths for atopic dermatitis, some people do like borax baths. And I think, you know, in that context, maybe it's okay. Rubbing it in a paste, smothering it. I have patients that crush garlic and put it on their vulva. I have patients that put, one of my colleagues was covering my inbox, and this patient was like, this is the discharge after I put yogurt in my vagina. Is that normal? And I was like, oh my God. But you never know what people are going to do unless you ask.
At what point do you switch to maintenance clobetasol when treating LS?
Great question. So typically, it's when I see the signs and symptoms getting better. So they're not itching, they're not painful. A lot of these women are asymptomatic. A lot of guys are asymptomatic, too. So I like to switch when I see that texture change improve. A lot of times, that crinkling texture change will improve before the color. And then you can drop them three times a week of that clobetasol. And then after 3 months, as long as they're not having any flares of the disease and their symptoms are better, then I even drop them down to triamcinolone or a lower potency steroid.
But you've been treating on your lecture, it's at about 4 weeks sometimes?
So it's 4 to 12 weeks. I was doing a research study, and honestly, some patients take 4 to 5 months before they'll get some of that improvement of the texture change. So everyone's different. I think if you have the luxury of being able to bring them back in 4 to 6 weeks, that'd be great to switch them to maintenance. I cannot do that anymore, and so I typically do a virtual visit at 6 to 8 weeks, make sure people are feeling better, and then bring them back at the 3 to 4 month point, and that's when I put them on maintenance.
Do you use topical calcineurin inhibitors or topical JAK inhibitors in treatment of lichen sclerosis?
So I think there's going to be a lot of exciting things coming out in the future, hopefully, with some of these agents. Personally, I think a lot of creams and some of those mentioned burn a lot, and so I do have colleagues that will use them for maintenance therapy, but by the time people get to me, I find that a lot of the calcineurin inhibitors just really burn, and so I just do the lower potent topical steroids. If a patient really wants to try a calcineurin inhibitor because they're afraid to use topical steroids, I'll try to talk them out of the steroid phobia first, but then, you know, put them on that if they'd like, but just let them know that it can burn. And I don't have as much experience with the JAK inhibitors.
Is there any concern about using estrogen vaginally and transfer of the hormone to a partner?
I guess theoretically it could, but I think I tell patients normally, you know, use that a lot of times using that twice a week, and so they're doing it at night, and I think that after about 30 minutes it's absorbed in the system, so it probably is fine.
Catherine asks, can topical estrogen be prescribed for vaginal dryness if a patient already uses an estradiol patch for menopausal symptoms?
It can. About 30% of patients need local hormone in addition to their patch. But again, I don't prescribe systemic estrogen. And so I think, you know, talking with your GYN colleagues or whoever is prescribing that patch to just kind of talk about those kind of next steps. But some people do, for sure.
Thank you so much. We have some more questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
What do you think about using Westcott scissors for genital biopsies?
Westcott's. I think those are the ones we use on eyelid, and that's what I use in my practice, like the Gradle scissors or the Westcott's. I think. Sorry.
Can you talk a little bit more about the appropriate procedure for biopsying a penis? When to shave versus punch? How deep do you need to go if you're doing a punch?
Yeah, so punch, like I said, punches I use for tumors. So when they're hard or I'm worried about skin cancer. So in that Paget's case, the extramammary Paget's, I would definitely do a punch. You want to get the bottom. You know, if you're worried about a squame, you want to do a punch. If you're worried about cancer at all, I would say do a punch. Otherwise, I think that modified shave technique I showed is really helpful. It goes into the dermis, but it doesn't get too deep, and it heals a lot easier. And so you just have an open, you know, erosion, basically, and it let it slowly heal over time. I think with guys, sometimes in the morning, you'll get the natural stretching, but also like doing that at night. But I think those first 2 weeks can be really sensitive for patients. So I think just talking about that with patients so they know what to expect will be important. And again, I don't like throwing stitches on the penis because I think that they can break, and then that can cause more of a problem or a scar down the line. But I think doing the dermablade is hard on the penis. So that's why I think that modified shave technique I showed would be a lot more helpful.
Can you talk about burning scrotal syndrome? Christine asks.
Yes, I was in Ted Rosen's talk earlier, and I liked his suggestion. I hadn't tried endomethacin. I think it's an incredibly challenging condition. I will say that a lot of those patients, I like to utilize some of those other medicines for itch or pain, like gabapentin, Cymbalta, or duloxetine, and other SSRIs. So, I mean, I think they can be incredibly challenging, though. I don't think there's an easy answer. I will say that a lot of times they do have, like, sometimes they'll have, like, pudendal neuralgia, or they'll have other things in their pelvis, or they'll have, like, a car accident, or they'll have, you know, problems in their spine. And so I actually have those patients. You know, men can get pelvic floor dysfunction too. And so I'm very fortunate to work with a physical medicine and rehab doc that runs a chronic pelvic pain program at UCSL Western. And so I send them to her. And sometimes these patients have something that we can fix. So
that's an interesting thought about, you know, not discriminating against men and offering them pelvic floor therapy. In that same vein, Catherine asks, how and when do you refer to PT for strengthening pelvic floor muscles?
Yeah, a lot of times those muscles are actually too tight. So it's high tone pelvic floor. And I tell patients, you know, I do a modified exam. I'm not the expert in your pelvic floor muscles. But a lot of times what you can do is and I'd say more for women, you can do some of this for like around the anal closing and opening for men, but I have them kind of bear down, you know, like they're trying to squeeze on my finger, and I put my finger in the vagina and I have them squeeze, and then a lot of times you won't feel any movement at all on their muscles, and then you ask them to relax and then you don't feel any movement at all. And the same for like the perianal skin. You can have them, you know, tense up and then release and you won't see very much movement at all. Or they'll be like bearing down and like, I mean, you guys have seen these patients. They like are all scrunched up and they're like, you know, it's like, okay, I just need to take a look here. And I mean, a lot of times these patients, or you ask them like, you know, if you have pain with sex, is at the beginning? You know, and I kind of explain, I'm like, does it feel like your body's trying to like tense up and brace for pain? Like you're, you know, just, oh, here it comes, I'm ready for it. And then they're like, yes, it's exactly right. I'm like, okay, well, you probably will need pelvic floor physical therapy. And I'd say in the community, there's a lot of pelvic floor physical therapists that aren't affiliated with, you know, doctors, and they do fantastic work. But we just have some doctors that also specialize in that. But I think just kind of finding out what's in your community and what resources you have that are local that you can interface with. And you'd be surprised what you can find. There's a really great pelvic floor physical therapy association that I kind of just Google, and you can put in patients' zip codes, and you can find a list of pelvic physical therapists that specialize in pelvic floor, and they can kind of look up and find one close to them. And I think that information, you know, can be helpful. I also tell them, you know, you don't want to go to someone that's doing like shoulders, hips, and like dabbles in this. You want to find someone that this is their area of expertise.
Sure. There were a couple of more very specific cases. So I would encourage you potentially, I think that Dr. Mosker would have a second to just talk about that case with you. But thank you so much, Dr. Mosker,
for
giving us your expertise.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah.